You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on.
Say you will.
Say it better,
yeah.
Come on now, say that you love me. Say that you need me. Say that you want me. You want
live from New York City, it's the Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles.
I still remember when you used to be
9 years. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knowles. Today, the latest on health, not just for humans, but cats and dogs. Then we're going to have a lot of commentaries. We're going to have a commentary on the coming climate famine anarchy by Dr. Glenn Berry of Echo Internet. And no hugging. Are we living through a crisis of touch? From Paula Consaza of The Guardian. And how do we understand sexual pleasure in this age of consent? By Heidi Matthews of Eon. Also, I'm going to bring two crises to the public's attention today, just so we can begin the process of unwrapping this very complex issue. One is killing of baby girls in India, also in Pakistan and China. The numbers are staggering. Just since the year 2000, just 2000, it's estimated that we're looking at least 14 million babies killed, if they're female. Why? We'll talk about that. Plus, look at an article by Towards Freedom called Over 4 Million People Displaced as Crisis Deepens in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So if you have 4 million people displaced, shouldn't that get our attention? Shouldn't at least we be aware of it? My guest in the second part of our program today is Vegas Tinold. He is a leading Norwegian investigative journalist, and he infiltrated several far-right movements, such as the KKK and the neo-Nazis. And so he's going to tell us what they're about and what they're fomenting, their mindset. I think it'll be interesting. Plus, we have some audio clips. We're going to share an audio clip that was on Tucker Carlson's last night. And I won't play the part with the guests because we played Professor Peterson yesterday doing a very insightful talk about how young boys are terrified of rejection by girls and what they do in stupid ways, but they don't know any better to get people's attention and why that is important that we understand this. So Tucker gives us some statistics. And he's right on this issue. Some issues I agree with him. Some I would separate my opinion. On this one, he is absolutely spot on. Also, if time permits, the biggest misconceptions about Israel and Palestinian conflict with Abby Martin. We're not going to be able to get all this on, but we'll get as much as we can. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. From the American Chemical Society, published in the Journal of Environmental Science, it's all about our cats and dogs consuming and processing parabens, para, P-A-R-A, bens, B-E-N-S. Now, in just lay language, because it's a very technical article, many households can claim at least one cat or a dog. But pets that primarily stay indoors can have increased rates of diseases like diabetes and kidney disease and hypothyroidism compared with those that stay exclusively outside. And some scientists propose that chemical substances in the home could contribute to these illnesses. One group has examined how pets can be exposed to parabens. And the parabens are preservatives commonly found. We are going to find them in cosmetics and pharmaceutical products, shampoos, conditioners. And the use in human food as in dogs and cat food. Now, the fact that it's regulated by the FDA means nothing. The substances also have been shown to be endocrine-disrupting compounds. Research has shown that these endocrine-disrupting compounds potentially interfere with hormones, which then cause harmful side effects in developmental and reproductive neurological systems. And previous studies have examined the presence of other compounds such as heavy metals and biphenyl A in pet food. But very little is known about parabens in this context, so a group of scientists wanted to examine the exposure of dogs and cats to parabens in commercially available pet food and analyze the substances in the animal's urine. They examined 58 variations of dog and cat food. They then took all these urine samples from the animals. And the paraben called methylparaben and the metabolite called 4-HB, which stands for hydroxybenzoic acid, were the most abundant chemicals detected in pet and urine, in the food, but also in the urine. And the dry food contained higher levels of parabens and their metabolites than wet food. In addition, the researchers report cat food had higher paraben concentration than dog food, and so that means that our dogs and our cats are being exposed. Now, for me, this is particularly important because I've seen so many of my friends who have dogs or cats who the dog or cat, generally at the age of 6 to 8, begins to take on arthritis, some form of dysplasia, sometimes tumors, hair starts falling out, skin is dry, chafing, recession of the gums. And when I say, are you brushing your dog's teeth or cat's teeth each day? They say, no. Well, you have to. No different than you would your own. Do you clean their ears out with some hydrogen peroxide? No. Well, that's what gives you that danky dog smell. It's the buildup of a bacteria and into a like a dark brown, really smelly mess in the ears. You can take it out once a week. Clean it out, disinfect it, that way they're less susceptible to ear mites. And what do you feed your... Well, I feed my dog and cat, you know, good food. What's good food? Good food is not what comes off your dinner table, and good food's not what comes out of a box or can. And then they start thinking, well, what kind of a hassle am I about to get into? And unfortunately, and this is the bad part, where people love their pets, they don't always feed them right. And so I give them a primer. I did a special on this. You know, I don't know if the special I did on PBS is up on YouTube or not, but it's called Natural Pet Care. And I show you the role of healthy diets in horses, dogs and cats, birds, fish, ferrets, all these. There are over 260 million of these pets. I have a cat named Sally. Sally's 25 years old. Now, how is it that Sally can be so healthy, even though she's probably lived twice the lifespan of the average cat? Because Sally doesn't eat anything out of a can. At nighttime, she goes out and she hunts. Whatever she finds, rats, and these are not your city rats. These are what are called palm rats. They live in the top of palm trees. Or rabbits, whatever she finds, she'll eat. So she's getting things that are rich in enzymes, unprocessed, and for her metabolism, especially the requirements cats have for tyrosine and some other unique nutrients, more so in dogs, it's perfect for her system. Then there is a supplementation of a drink that I make, that I put certain nutrients in each day that will help her, especially the nutrients that will keep her circulation strong, keep bacteria down, keep inflammation from flaring up. Every morning when I'm at home, I live in New York, but I also live in Florida, One of the first things I do when I get up early and go and prepare all the animals' food, because I have an animal, small animal sanctuary. I've had much larger ones, but they were enormously costly to maintain, and everyone and their mother would be putting some kind of animal at the front gate in the morning, and you don't know the background. Generally, people are too embarrassed to tell you why the animal is there. But more often than not, the animals are malnourished. Frequently, they're terrified. They've been traumatized. So you have spent a lot of time and energy getting them well. Even here's one of those things that there's no easy answer to, but after the hurricane, the morning after the hurricane in front of the barn, there were not one, not two, but three orphaned babies, probably no more than 2 or 3 days old, a baby squirrel and two baby rabbits. And they were not the same breed of rabbit. Now, there has never, in 23 years of living at a ranch in Florida, there's never been a time when babies have shown up at the door of the barn and not mixed species. All of them were taken in, and immediately I started a protocol to help them, knowing what baby animals of each species need. And they are healthy and thriving and released into the wild. They stick around every day. And they're so used to the other animals that there I got a picture of it. I'm going to put it up on the website. There's the little squirrel who goes right over to the baby donkey, gets up and grabs the donkey by the nose and gives it a kiss every morning. And there's the, she goes over to the dog and climbs up on the dog and sometimes tries to bury a nut in the dog's hair. It's just cute beyond imagination. But this is the way nature works sometimes. And then there's a squirrel that got attacked by raccoons and should have died. It's all of its, virtually all of the skin on its back, all of its fur was ripped off and left hanging. Normally they die in massive infections within hours or trauma from the shock. But managed to get it and put colloidal silver and Manuka honey and then hand feed it, and it's doing well. It survived. So when you're around animals, you know what they need, you know the responses, you know how to work with them. But it's all in the food. And one of those animals every day, when I'm at home, not on the road filming, is Auntie. Auntie is the senior creature at the sanctuary. In human years, she would be about 214 years old. She's a almost 33-year-old ringtailed lemur. At least as far as I could research, the oldest living lemur in the world that is known. The next one, I believe, is 27. And yet just as active as she can be, so I go out to make sure that bond with her, give her hugs and groom her and give her a special diet. And she thrives. She had been dead a long time ago if it weren't for her diet and the care that she's given. Finally, from Texas A&M University, turmeric, a component that's very important, can ease Gulf War illness for veterans. That's correct. Turmeric, or curcumin, is actually the active ingredient of turmeric, and it can reverse some of the effects of Gulf War syndrome. Now, by the way, Gulf War illness affects over 400,000 veterans from the first Gulf War, who came home with symptoms like sleep disorders, chronic fatigue, memory problems, neurological disorders, infections that didn't go away, ulcers in their skin that wouldn't heal. And also a lot of that was mood dysfunction, hypersensitive skin, and gastrointestinal problems as a result of the exposure to pesticides and chemicals, nerve gas, and the vaccines. But now they're finding in the publication Brain Behavior and Immunity that curcumin can make an enormous difference. So if you know someone with Gulf War syndrome, let them see the literature, encourage them to use curcumin. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 27 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Recently, in fact, at the October 2017 retreat, I met a person named Sal who had end-stage lung cancer, stage 4, advanced. Nothing could be done, and he was advised hospice care and given some death dates if he did nothing. And so Sal showed up, and he was couldn't stand up straight. Had trouble speaking, very raspy voice. But he was a trooper. He stuck with the protocol, did everything he was asked to do, and then he left and went home and got some tests taken by his oncologist. And lo and behold, they found that his cancer was not only not growing, it was shrinking. So 2 months later, continuing the protocol, even having it modified, just this past week, this past Monday, Sal went in to the same oncologist and had his test taken again. And this time, he was told, your tumors are not growing, they're shrinking even more. I don't know what you're doing, his doctor said, but keep it up. Sal, is that an accurate description of what has happened to you?
Yeah, Gary, that's pretty close to what happened there, actually. I couldn't get her to admit that any of the alternative stuff I was doing was doing me any good. But she did say at the end, oh, by the way, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. You know, they're just so locked into treating this disease a certain way. They can't get around whatever it is, you know, the drug companies are selling. That's all they do, you know, so...
You were on all those opiates for pain, and mm-hmm. You're not on those now, right?
No. Well, a little bit now and then, but it's not a daily thing anymore. You know, I got it down to where I went for a couple of weeks without them. Then the pain came back a little bit. I had to take a little bit. But that not being a daily routine is another big plus.
What are the symptoms that you have today that show you're improving your health versus 4 months ago?
Well, you know, physical activity. I can get up. I can walk. I can, you know, walk. I walk a mile every day at least. I can walk a couple of miles if I want to. You know, I don't feel impaired in any way by my breathing.
All right.
You know, it's my lungs are working.
And yet you've passed your death date. So by orthodox standards, you should be dead, and you're not. Your cancer is shrinking and continuing to shrink.
Continuing to shrink, and I'm continuing on the protocol. And it really gave me a lot of hope that this thing can be dealt with. You know, I don't have to just get my affairs in order and go home and die.
Well, we're happy. We're very happy for you, Sal.
Well, and I look forward to you, Gary, because you were a big part in helping.
Good. Well, thank you for calling in. I just wanted an update on your latest medical examination. So Sal's
appreciate that you take an interest like this, Gary. It's uplifting for me personally. Thank you.
All right. All the best, Sal. Lou Ann Panessi's on the line. Lou Ann, do you have anything to add to what Sal was saying?
Well, having been an oncology nurse for over 40 years, Gary, I will tell you without any hesitation that it is unheard of to have someone with a stage 4 lung cancer in the space of, you know, 4 to 6 weeks immediately start to have the cancer diminish, and then within 4 months have it virtually gone. It's unheard of. And this is not the first time. We've had people with emphysema, with COPD. We had that woman with lung cancer who came down, and she had an oxygen tank strapped to her back. before she went out walking, and she couldn't say two words without stopping to take a breath. And by the end of the retreat, which was 3 weeks later, this woman was power walking without her oxygen. It only took her 2 days to get her oxygen off of her, and she was able to go a whole lot farther than she ever imagined she could. So there's something to be said for changing one's lifestyle. Some people would say radically. I'm just saying change it for the better. When you have a deeper understanding of what the root causes are of your imbalances, dear Lord, it changes everything. When you have a deeper understanding, you're working from a place of intellect, from information, from common sense, Gary, from common sense. Then versus just living with your conditioned self where it's predictable, where it's comfortable, even though it's killing you. And that's what I've seen. That's what I've seen people do. They justify, they rationalize. It's more important for them, just like your friend, Tom, who it was more important for him to be with his people and drinking and smoking and being accepted by his group than not. And standing up for his own health and his own life. Because there was no life if there weren't those toxic people around him. And that's the sad part, is that we adapt to these people. But we help people at our retreat to get out of that mode. And for me, it's been an absolute privilege and just a pleasure to be a part of people's healing journeys, to watch them go from completely diseased and dysfunctional to leaving with a sense of hope and happiness and really enthusiasm for life. That's
got a question. One last quick question here. You had three life-ending diseases when you came to a lecture I did years ago, and then from that lecture that you're, some fellow you were seeing at that time brought you to, I don't remember meeting him, you came to a retreat, and that started your journey because it opened your mind. Do you believe that you would have lived to this day had you not made those changes and those sacrifices?
Oh, heavens, no. No. My sister died from breast cancer. I was actually diagnosed at the same time she was, but I never discussed it with anyone. I never told my family. I never told anyone about it. You were the only person, I think, I mentioned it to, but I never told anybody because, you know, all the attention was on my sister, and she actually tried to do some of the things on the protocol, but she would never allow herself to release herself from her past angst, anger, and rage. She wouldn't allow herself to do it. But, oh, she had her green juices, and she got her IV therapies, and she did very, very well in spite of it. And then after she saw that all her tumors shrank and she felt great, what do you think she did, Gary? She went right back to her toxic relationship, to working nights, to going back to a toxic diet, and the cancer came back with a vengeance. And after she died, my brother-in-law said, well, I guess that Gary Nall stuff didn't work. Oh, yes, it did. It was that 50%. It was her mental attitude that kept her from healing herself. She needed to cling to that. But I tell you, I would have been dead, oh, I would say easily 15 years ago, if not more, because I had hepatitis, I had breast cancer, I had chronic fatigue syndrome, I had herpes 6, I had cytomegalovirus, I had all those things. And a lot of them were just a side effect of being a nurse. You're exposed to immunosuppressed people that are loaded with these very mutant viruses. And I was loaded with them. So it was an amazing journey for me to get my mind out of my old belief system and to step into a world of health and happiness and hope. And I wish that on everyone. And I've dedicated my entire life, my profession, to now helping people to capture that spirit that they may have lost.
Good for you. A lot of people are alive today because the changes you made, you've been able to pass them forward. They're making them. And then hopefully they'll pass it forward to other people. That's if you've got a gift, share the gift. That's the rule of life for those who are coming from a moral and more humanistic perspective. Thank you for being on, Luann, and Sal also. We look forward to seeing him again. And as you said, very few people can show in Orthodox medicine, nobody can show end-stage lung cancer reverse. And yet we also had Eutrice Lead in stage class. She called me from intensive care.
Yes.
And wanting to know, was there anything that could be done? I said, sure. And for the next 4 months, work with her every day. And her diabetes went away, lost 100 pounds, and she's alive and still functioning.
But wait, she also more. Competed for the first time in her life as an athlete in a track and field race walking race. And she won a medal.
Yeah. She's a trooper. And she gave it her best, and that's what people have to do, unless they're my friends. Maybe I'll select a different quality of friend in the future, ones that are willing to go for their own health. Well, thank you, Luann.
My pleasure.
Luann Panessi. If anyone wants to reach you, give us your number.
Surely. It's 903-881-7008. That's 903-881-7008.
Thank you. Now, before we go to our guest who's standing by, let us listen to what Tucker Carlson has to say on a men's issue. And though I can take and do take issue with Tucker Carlson on several things, on this one, he's got it right. And I don't see anyone else in the media taking on the issue of how can we have healthy, happy men in America instead of propagating this constant artificial war about men against women, women against men. That's so childish. It's so foolish. Here's Tucker, and I'm not going to play the part with his guest, just him, and the statistics he is citing are accurate. Please listen.
If you're a middle-aged man, you probably know a peer who has killed himself in recent years, at least one. If you're a parent, you may have noticed that your daughter's friends seem a little more on the ball than your son's. They get better grades, they smoke much less marijuana, they spend less time playing video games, they go to more prestigious colleges. If you're an employer, you may have noticed that your female employees show up on time. The young men often don't. And of course, if you live in this country, you've just seen a horrifying series of mass shootings, far more than we've ever had. Women didn't do that. In every case, the shooter was a man. Something ominous is happening to men in America. Everyone who pays attention knows that. What's odd is how rarely you hear it publicly acknowledged. Our leaders pledge to create more opportunities for women and girls, whom they imply are failing. Men don't need help. They're the patriarchy. They're fine, more than fine. But are they fine? Here are the numbers. Start with the most basic, life and death. The average American man will die 5 years before the average American woman. One of the reasons for this is addiction. Men are more than twice as likely as women to become alcoholics. They're also twice as likely to die of a drug OD. In New Hampshire, one of the states hardest hit by the opioid crisis, 73% of overdose deaths were men. But the saddest reason for shortened lifespans is suicide. 77% of all suicides in America are committed by men. The overall rate is increasing at a dramatic pace. Between 1997 and 2014, there was a 43% rise in suicide deaths among middle-aged American men. The rates are highest among American Indian and white men, who kill themselves at about 10 times the rate of Hispanic and black women. You often hear America's incarceration crisis. Well, that's almost exclusively a male problem, too. Over 90% of inmates are men. Now, these problems are complex, but we know that they start young. And relative to girls, boys are failing in school. More girls than boys graduate high school, considerably more go to and graduate from college. In schools at every level, boys account for the overwhelming majority of discipline cases. One study found that fully 1 in 5 high school boys had been diagnosed with some form of hyperactivity disorder. That's compared with just 1 in 11 girls. Many of them were medicated for it. The long-term health effects of those medications, not fully understood. But they do appear to include depression in later life. Women now decisively outnumber men in graduate school. They earn the majority of doctoral degrees. They're now the majority of new enrollees in both law and medical schools. For men, the consequences of failing in school are long-term and profound. Between 1979 and 2010, working-age men with only high school degrees saw their real hourly wages drop about 20%. Over the same period, high school-educated women saw their wages rise. The decline of the industrial economy disproportionately hurt men. There are now 7 million working-age men in America who don't work. They've dropped out of the labor force. Nearly half of them take pain medication on any given day. That is the highest rate in the world by far. Far fewer young men get married than did just a few decades ago, and fewer stay married. About 1 in 5 American children live now only with their mothers. That's double the rate of 1970. Millions more boys growing up without fathers. Young adult men are now more likely to live with a parent than they are to live with a spouse or a partner. That is not the case for young women. Single women buy their own homes at more than twice the rate of single men. More women than men now have driver's licenses. Whenever gender differences come up in public debate, the so-called wage gap seems to dominate the conversation. You've heard it. A woman makes 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. That's a statistic that you'll hear a lot. Presidents have repeated it, many candidates. It's everywhere. And yet that number compares all American men to all American women across all professions. No legitimate social scientist would consider that a valid or meaningful measure. The number doesn't mean anything. It's intentionally misleading. It's a talking point. Once you compare men and women with similar experience, working the same hours and similar jobs for the same period of time, that's the only way you can measure it, the gap all but disappears. In fact, it may invert. One study using census data found that single women in their 20s living in metropolitan areas now earn 8% more on average than their male counterparts. By the way, the majority of managers in the workplace are now women. Women, on average, are scoring higher on IQ tests than men are. Even physically, men are falling behind. A recent study found that almost half of young men failed the Army's entry-level physical fitness exam during basic training. Fully 70% of American men are now overweight or obese. That's compared to 59% of American women. Perhaps most bafflingly and terrifyingly, men seem to be becoming less male fundamentally. Measurably. Sperm counts, for example, across the West have plummeted. They're down almost 60% since the early 1970s. Scientists don't know why this is. Testosterone levels in men have also fallen precipitously. One study found that average levels of male testosterone dropped by 1% every year after 1987, and it's not related to age. In other words, the average 40-year-old man in 2017 would have testosterone levels 30% lower than the average 40-year-old man in 1987. There is no upside to this trend. Lower testosterone levels in men are associated with depression, lethargy, weight gain, decreased cognitive ability. Nothing like this has ever happened to a population this big. So you'd think we'd want to know exactly why. What's going on? How do we fix it? And yet the media ignore that story. It's considered a fringe topic somehow. Nor is it, believe it or not, a priority in the scientific research establishment. We checked, and we couldn't find a single NIH-funded study on why testosterone levels are falling. We did find a study on, quote, pubic hair grooming prevalence and motivation among women in the U.S. So those are the numbers, and they paint a very clear picture. American men are failing in body, in mind, and in spirit. This is a crisis. Yet our leaders pretend it's not happening, and in fact, they tell us the opposite is true. Women are victims. Men are oppressors. To question that assumption is to risk punishment. Even as women far outpace men in higher education, for example, virtually every college campus supports a women's studies department whose core goal is to attack male power. Our politicians and business leaders internalize and amplify that message. Men are privileged, women are oppressed. Hire and promote and reward accordingly. Now, that would be fine if it were true, but it's not true. At best, it's an outdated view of an America that no longer exists.
First of all, pass on, if anyone knows Tucker Carlson, pass on my gratitude that someone in the mainstream media had the courage and the decency to look at what's going on with men, and especially young boys, and why we are in this crisis. We need compassionate, thoughtful, non-reactive, but reasoned minds to try to resolve this issue so that we can help all people, and they deserve it. My guest is on the line now. We're going directly over there and say hello again to Vegas Tenold, T-E-N-O-L-D. As I mentioned earlier, he's a Norwegian investigative journalist currently living in the United States who's been covering the American far-right movements such as the KKK and neo-Nazis since 2011. He has also covered human rights issue in Russia and American national security and conflicts in Africa and the Middle East. He's a graduate from Columbia University School of Journalism, and his articles have appeared in New York Times and Rolling Stone, Al Jazeera. And he's the author of Everything You Will Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. Happy International Women's Day.
Thank you. When you started your research and field work into these far-right fascist, racist, and white nationalist organizations, you never expected they would reach a level of power and influence in our society and political events. However, after Trump won in 2016, I would imagine you've had to reevaluate their role in shaping this culture and perhaps in the broader sense, the degree of hatred towards the other that exists in this nation. And unlike the information and impressions we might get from watchdog organizations on white militia groups such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, you infiltrated and were accepted into three of the larger white nationalist groups, the KKK, the neo-Nazi, and the anti-Semitic National Socialist Movement, and the Traditionalist Workers' Party, another nationalist organization, but more with the goal of preserving the U.S. solely for whites rather than being vocally racist with hate-filled language. Tell us about what you observed, what you experienced while in the white nationalist organizations for the past 7 years.
Sure. I want to make it clear, though, I didn't infiltrate them. I was very open with who I was and that I was a journalist and that I was a socialist at that, which kind of makes me their ideological enemy, I suppose. So they were always very aware of who I was and what I wanted to do. There's a part in the book where it's election night 2016, and I'm at Matthew Heimbach, the leader of the Traditionalist Workers' Party's house in Paoli, Indiana. And throughout the day, we kind of been talking about what would happen the next day when Hillary took power. As pretty much everyone else in the country, we just assumed that Hillary was going to win it. And of course, that didn't happen. We all remember the New York Times odds needle that was lodged firmly on 95% pretty much all day, and then took a nosedive. So the next day, I think we were all pretty much struggling to figure out what had happened. And you know, I was always thinking, should I have seen this coming? Is this something I should have? I mean, I was there to see this rise of far-right nationalism in America, but I don't think even I saw it coming. My one comfort in covering these groups was sort of that they would always be fringe. They would never have their views validated in the sense that, well, they just did. So I don't think I saw it coming either. I mean, I think a lot of them did. I was once at a barbecue in Trenton, New Jersey, with a bunch of neo-Nazis sitting in a backyard that they had decorated with swastika banners, and they'd lit a swastika on fire, and they were standing in the rain, Sieg Heiling this thing. And I was talking to a man called Jeff Scoop, who is the leader of the National Socialist Movement, which is the largest neo-Nazi group in America. And he was telling me about how America was ready for their message. America was ready for a nationalist candidate and a nationalist president. And, you know, I thought he was crazy. I thought he was huffing glue. But it turns out 6 years before it happened, he saw Trump coming. I think they understood how angry and how racially divided the country still is.
Shouldn't we pause for a moment and reflect on what you just said? Because there's a big difference between the neo-Nazis, the racists, the nationalists, and the vast majority of Americans who at one time, including unionists, who voted Democratic, would have voted for Hillary Clinton had any time the original Clintons and Obamas honored their word. These people didn't like Trump. They weren't Nazis. They just couldn't stand being lied to again. Shouldn't you make that distinguish? Otherwise, it's sounding like everyone who voted for Trump is a redneck nationalist, hate-mongering, you know, baby-throwing in the air person. Oh. That's not true.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want to make that perfectly clear. You don't have to be a racist of any sort to vote for Donald Trump, although it must be a pretty big pill to swallow as he keeps race baiting and dog whistling. But I think, you know, I spent a lot of time traveling through Appalachia and traveling through the Rust Belt. And the truth is that these people had no real incentive to vote Democrats. I mean, things have gotten progressively bad in Appalachia as coal and steel took a decline in the 80s. But under Obama, and I'm not really blaming Obama for this either, but things got really, really bad. And so there was no reason for voters in the Rust Belt and in coal country to believe that things would get better under another Democratic administration. And, you know, they all told me, a lot of people told me that they didn't believe that Trump was going to bring coal back, but at least he had the common decency to come and lie to their faces rather than, you know, just completely ignore them. So I think, you know, although I think that the Trump vote also did fall across, fall a lot on racial lines. I think obviously economic policies and the fact that Democrats have been ignoring large parts of the electorate for a long time played a big part in it.
Thank you. I appreciate you clarifying that. There seems to be two main popular personalities, at least the ones I'm aware of. There may be more in the white nationalism movement. One is Matthew Heimbach, who has been called the Little Fuhrer, and the other, Richard Spencer, who comes off more as a well-educated, corporate-looking politician. And when someone such as Spencer is invited to lecture on university campuses, there's a problem. Tell us a bit about more of these two guys and what kind of positions they represent. What are they trying to sell out there, and how are they being received?
Okay, so Spencer and Heimbach represent respectively the what's sort of colloquially known as the suits and the boots in the movement. Matthew Heimbach has been, you know, he fancies himself an intellectual, and to a degree compared to a lot of people he is, but he's also a guy who likes to march in the street and to rally. And Spencer, on the other hand, has been more of a glorified blogger, at least up until the point where he got punched in the face on Inauguration Day. And one of the problems of the far right is that the two factions have never really gotten along. They've never seen eye to eye, and they've never had any respect for each other. The suits have seen the boots as, you know, mindless thugs, and the boots have seen the suits as, you know, martini sipping dandies. And I think, you know, you saw the two factions try to get together in Charlottesville with disastrous results. But I still that's like a little tete-a-tete that's still ongoing. Matthew was providing security for Richard Spencer at Michigan State University the other day. But I think their idea for America is much the same. I mean, they're all arguing for this stop the hate and separate. Eventually, we need a white ethno state and all this kind of nonsense. And, you know, Richard Spencer is the guy who came up with the term alt-right, and he's become kind of the spokesperson for that movement. But the term itself is dangerous and misleading because it implies that there is something new about Richard Spencer and his guys and what they peddle. And, of course, that's not true. It's the same old tired nationalist rhetoric that we've heard for decades. And, you know, we've had people who've been well-spoken and who wore suits before on the far-right movement. That doesn't mean that their rhetoric is anything new. I mean, if there's something new, it's that they have Twitter now. But other than that, there's really nothing else they have to offer.
At any time during your multiple conversations over these 7 years, did you ever have a historical discussion of what went on in Italy in the 1920s with Mussolini and his black shirts, and what went on with Hitler in the early 1930s to show what this did and the reality?
I'm not a historian, so you know, I don't know enough about Italy in the 20s and Germany in the 30s. But I mean, they certainly were very preoccupied with that, and I think their view of history is quite revisionist at times. We absolutely got into that a few times. You know, mostly we talked about their theories about the Holocaust, which is extremely revisionist, you know, to the degree that they feel like it almost didn't happen, or they were prisoner of war camps and that kind of stuff. But, you know, the real nitty-gritty, Matthew Heimbach is really inspired by the Spanish fascists and the Romanian fascist movement. And these are movements that I'm not well versed in. So the real nitty-gritty historical discussions, I don't think they were had. But they're interesting.
My final question, what would be the takeaway message, especially since we have younger people willing to fight back and protest these fascists and these racists? What do you see the future, in the near future at least, of these white supremacists being?
For one, I worry about the increasing violence between the National Socialists, the white supremacists, and Antifa. I fully get the impulse of wanting to punch a Nazi, but it's getting to the point where I think we're going to see some serious injuries and deaths. We've already had the tragic death of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, and I think that's only going to get worse. The best thing to happen to the far right in recent years was Richard Spencer getting punched. I've never seen anything unite and galvanize the movement such as that. So I don't think it's an effective strategy. I think we need to protest, and I think we need to make our opinions known, and we need to make sure that they see that we're there and that we're many, many more than they are. But I don't think violence works. I think we also need to understand that white supremacy isn't something that just exists within the ranks of the KKK and the neo-Nazis and the fascists. They're almost a distraction. I mean, it's important to understand them because we need to understand how racism works. But the real white supremacy in this country is, of course, systemic, and that's going gangbusters. I mean, the incarceration rates, housing, segregation, that's all a form of white supremacy that doesn't need the Klan to survive. It's doing quite well. So I think we need to understand that.
I appreciate the sacrifice you made, Vegas, to go into these groups, spend the time, understand their mindset so that you could share it with others to see how dangerous these people are to a democracy and to stopping the hate campaigns that they foment. Yeah. Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Vegas Tienold, and he is the author of a book on the topic I would definitely recommend, entitled Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America, something we all should abhor. Finally, this coming Sunday at 6:30, I will continue with my webinar series. I've done 5 in the last year, and it's a way that I can do something that I feel is important on a topic that is relevant to a lot of people. This one's about sexual healing, everything about human sexuality, much of which is confusing today, much of which is repressive today. People don't know what to do, how to think. Even some of the comics of the past, Mort Saul and Richard Pryor and Lenny Bruce, they would be shunned today, or they would be shamed today. Not that they should be, but they were at a time when the sexual revolution was in its first dynamic waves, and they exploited the nuances of it in their humor. Now everything is so politically correct, people are afraid to say or do anything. What does this portend? How can we actually get to where that which is essential to us, if we choose to engage in healthy, happy sex, we can? It'll be a 2.5-hour evening starting at 6:30. Go to prn.fm for more information, or go to garynoll.com and sign in. It'll be packed like all of them are. So if you don't get in now, there won't be bandwidth to get in later. Every one of these on healing the brain naturally, women's health, these were all very popular. And I'm happy to do them. A lot of new insights. And I'll be taking questions from the audience. So any question you have, you'll be given an opportunity to share that question with me, and I'll be happy to address it. That's this coming Sunday evening, 6:30 it starts. It'll end around, I wanted to end it before The Walking Dead. If those of you want to see that, you can. So it'll end about 8:45. All right. Finally, the biggest misconceptions about Israel and Palestinian conflict with Abby Martin.
So you went to Palestine. What would you say is the biggest, most common misconception people have in regards to the Israeli-Palestine conflict?
That they're not, it's not an equal fight, and it's not a conflict that just fuels each other. There's one side that's colonized and the other side that's colonizers, one side that's oppressed and the other side that's the oppressors. It's a land that was a colonial settlement project, openly ethnically cleansing people. It's pretty much the most obvious example of settler colonialism that's still going on, and ethnic cleansing. And they've just been given carte blanche under the Trump administration, because you see bills now being presented in the Israeli and the Knesset that want to annex the entire rest of the West Bank. Another big myth that we hear is that a two-state solution is possible, and that's what we need. When you look at how the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem, which are the three territories of Palestine, how they're all laid out, there is no state to be had, because you can't just conjoin these three random things over like this giant map and be like, okay, this is your state. Gaza is an open-air prison where they send, you know, people to die and starve. It's all controlled by Israel. There's 90% unpotable water. The West Bank is a territory that is all littered with illegal settlements. So you go to these Arab villages in the West Bank, and there's just a settlement on top of an Arab village. Like, you have to be really insane to move across the world and want to move right on top of an Arab village when there's like hundreds of miles of empty Arab land in the rest of Israel proper. So two big myths is the two-state solution. Really what there needs to be is one state with just equal rights. You know, that just is the only thing that can happen. And just the whole equal fight. I mean, Palestinians cannot own firearms. They're under military law. Like, they are literally under martial law in the West Bank. They can't even hold a flag. They can't be a member of a political party. If you're in a congregation of 10 people, that's like illegal, because it means that you're like part of an organization or a protest. So all of these things, imagine being under like martial law, where you're just policed all the time. You have to go through these crazy checkpoints. You're harassed, you're dehumanized. If you're found with something that can be construed as a weapon, you can go to jail for 10 years. People who post things on Facebook, the amount of likes and shares that a Facebook post can get, if you post a photo of someone who died, you can go to prison for the amount of like days of the likes and shares of the Facebook post. So there are so many horrible things, not to mention there was just 500 kids arrested. Like, I just saw a report of how many kids are tortured and arrested. So people, you know, Israel's whole survival is based on projecting what it does to Palestine onto themselves. So they claim that they need this giant security apparatus in order to be safe. That's not true at all. They are illegally occupying an entire swath of territory, and they are policing and brutalizing an entire population on a daily basis. And it is not an equal fight. And we just hear, I mean, the first thing I remember after 9/11 was seeing that propaganda footage of Palestinians dancing in the mm-hmm. street. And I also remember hearing that Palestine did it. So what does that kind of propaganda do? You know, like, just planting the seeds and just this indoctrination. I didn't even know what Palestine was until I was 18 years old. So I think that we're just so indoctrinated and brainwashed with the one side of the narrative. We don't really know the truth, and we don't know how bad it is. Man, it is really, really bad, and it's way worse than I thought until I went and saw how crazy it is. There's just like, there's this place called Hebron that is the most visual representation of apartheid I can fathom. I mean, it's just people are just in cages. Like, Palestinians live there. It's become a ghost town. Israeli settlers have come on top of them and put cages where they just throw like diapers and alcohol, and just like, they just treat them like animals, because that's honestly what they are. I also went and talked to Israelis. I talked to hundreds of Palestinians. I also went and talked to a lot of Israelis in Jerusalem in a place called Tolerance Square. And I was talking to them. I said, what do you think about the situation? Like, very general questions. And about 90% of them said openly genocidal things, like, let's carpet bomb them, let's exterminate them. So I think that a lot of people don't realize kind of the fascistic tendencies of Israelis and the settler colonial mindset. It's not a very peaceful society, and it's not necessarily like a democratic society like it paints itself to be. So they want to claim that these settlers are really extreme and they're an aberration. That's not true at all. It's the same kind of sentiments inside Israel than you would see, you know, out in the settlements. So but it's disturbing.
There isn't a big... do we run the risk of making the mistake of that Israelis are the Likud party, just like the Americans aren't the Republican party, right?
Sure.
There's a lot of people who push back against the wars and push back against stuff. Isn't there a lot of people inside Israel who push back against the apartheid state?
So there are a lot of people, and this is a thing that you'll see also, is a lot of people, left is a slur. There are a lot of liberal Zionists, who kind of paint the language of human rights and the two-state solution. And yes, they are pushing back. They hate Netanyahu. They hate the fascistic takeover of the country. But they still, at the end of the day, think that the occupation is like...
Moral,
in a way. Like, they want a more humane occupation.
Okay.
But a lot of leftists have fled. My friend Ronnie Barkin, who is an Israeli anti-Zionist, says that, you know, leftists are getting harder and harder to come by there because there's only so much you can take in a society that's becoming increasingly fascist. I think that Israel started off a lot more communistic. It was a lot more of like these kibbutz type people who were like socialist minded. And now it's become a very different project. And I mean, it's just, and it doesn't even matter really what Israelis think at the end of the day, because what needs to happen is restoring basic human rights and ending the apartheid.
Have a wonderful day, everyone.